WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The debate over gun control has gone on for years with little progress in either direction. In the aftermath of the murder of school children at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, new calls for gun control began to be heard around the country. In last week's State of the Union address, President Obama implored Congress to take up the issue, referencing Newtown, Aurora, Colorado, Chicago, and other places that have witnessed gun-related violence. The sad truth, according to the AtlanticWire.com, is that there have been 1,793 gun-related deaths in the United States since the shootings at Sandy Hook occurred just 2 months ago. 1,793. That's about half the number of people killed on 9/11. And if those numbers hold true, by the end of 2013, we will have lost three times the number of people killed on 9/11 to guns. We have a history of gun violence in this country. We also have a history of gun ownership backed by the Second Amendment to the Constitution. We have a right to bear arms, and in truth, the vast majority of gun owners never commit a crime with those weapons. They own them to hunt. They own them for protection. They own them to collect them. They own them because they can. The arguments for and against gun control are not unlike those for and against abortion. People on both sides feel strongly about their beliefs and their rights, and there seems to be little room for movement or even debate. But today we continue to search for some wiggle room. In advance of a WFAE public conversation on the topic tonight at 7 at the Booth Playhouse, we take up the issue this hour. We're joined by Congressman Mel Watt, a Democrat from North Carolina's 12th Congressional District and a member of the House Judiciary Committee. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Also with us in our Spirit Square studio is Dr. Lance Stell, professor of philosophy and director of medical humanities at Davidson College and a clinical professor of medicine at Carolina's Medical Center. He teaches ethics, among other topics, and has written a paper called "The Production of Criminal Violence in America: Is Strict Gun Control the Solution?" Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And Larry Hyatt is the owner and president of Hyatt Guns, the largest independently owned gun store in the country, located here in our region. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
Why is it that the largest gun store in the country is located here?
Well, there's a lot of reasons, but number one is the crackdown on the number of FFLs that happened some years back.
What's an FFL?
That is the federal firearms license that everybody that sells guns has to have. A lot of the smaller dealers, they call them kitchen dealers, were there. They couldn't renew their license or get a license, and it became a big reduction in the number of gun dealers. Also, the big box stores like the Bass Pro Shops or Gander Mountains and Cabela's started taking over the market, and that shrunk the market further because they couldn't compete with the big boxes. Stores like ours grew because there was room for it, particularly for service, gunsmithing, carrying all the gun products and guns that were not the 2% best sellers. There's a lot of economics involved.
So are your customers primarily from this area, or do you have customers from all over the world, all over the country?
From our retail, it's about a 100-mile radius that drive to it, and then the Internet, it's all over the United States. But it's not all over the world because it's really almost impossible to sell guns to other countries.
The number that I cited at the beginning, 1,793 deaths by guns in just 2 months since Sandy Hook, does that surprise anybody at this table?
Certainly doesn't surprise me. Newtown was a tragic, terrible incident, but there are new towns going on in our communities one by one virtually every day, and the statistics are astounding.
Are we alone in that? I think we lead the world in that, but are we alone? Are there other countries where similar murder statistics, be it by gun or knife or strangulation or some other method, are they as high as ours per capita?
Some are much higher. Russia, for example, is much higher homicide rate than we have.
And how do they do it?
Well, they do it in a lot of ways. They have severe restrictions on firearms, and it's illegal for private citizens to have handguns. So they manage to achieve a very high homicide rate without facilitation by firearm. When we think about suicide, I was wondering how many of the individuals or the number that you mentioned, were there suicides in that number or were they all murders?
I don't know the answer to that. There have been a lot of tragedies with guns, high-profile tragedies with guns since President Obama took office. Gabby Gifford, of course, that tragedy out there, and the movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, was on his watch. Now Sandy Hook Elementary, which really shocked the nation, I think. We're almost unshockable these days because there are so many violent acts anymore. But that really got people's attention. Has it galvanized politically enough people to do anything about this? Or is this just another exercise in futility that we'll look back on in a year from now and say, well, nothing happened there either?
I think the jury is still out on that, whether we'll accomplish anything, but it's certainly galvanized enough attention for people to sit down and try to figure out how you can navigate in this atmosphere. Mm-hmm. I think there's a significant appetite to reduce gun violence. The question of how you do it and how you do it constitutionally is a very difficult question to answer. And the appetite is there. Whether we can navigate through it, I think, is still remains to be seen.
We're going to talk extensively about what's in your paper, Dr. Stell, but let me ask you a straight question here. Should we try to control it?
Well, I think we have quite a bit of legal control on what people do with firearms. Compliance is much less than we would like. That's for sure on the murder side. So murder is illegal, and murdering somebody with a handgun or any kind of firearm is illegal. Mm-hmm. The restrictions that we put on people who may legally possess firearms is quite extensive. So if someone is convicted of a felony, they're lifetime prohibited from possessing a firearm or ammunition.
But it doesn't stop them from having a firearm or ammunition.
Well, it doesn't. Making things illegal does not, in fact, stop people from doing things that are illegal. That's quite right.
The sale of guns skyrocketed after what happened at Sandy Hook in Newtown, Connecticut. As I understand it, you, Larry Hyatt, sold more than $1 million worth of firearms in one day. It was a record-breaking day for single-day sales. Is that correct?
Well, we had $1 million worth of orders. There wasn't enough product to fill them. But it was unprecedented in the number of orders we had, mainly through the Internet. It was almost a panic buy. And I think Sandy Hook was probably the most frightening thing to legal gun owners that's ever happened, because it was so tragic and it hit our hearts so hard, the whole country at Christmas, that I think the American people were worried that they may pass some restrictive law. This might be one that caused it.
And, well, I was going to ask you whether the panic was because they felt unsafe and wanted more guns in their arsenal because they wanted to protect themselves, their families, their businesses, their property, or were they afraid that if they didn't buy these guns now, by God, they were going to pass something in Congress that would stop all of this?
We had a lot of first-time buyers for the reason they thought if they didn't act then, that later on it would be either impossible or even more difficult to buy a firearm. The whole country did this, except for the places where you can't buy a firearm, such as New York City or Chicago. Right. The rest of the country, it wasn't just doubling or tripling. It was 10 times the normal amount of stuff being bought. And ammunition. The shelves are empty in the country as we speak now. Just whatever the factories make is all the product that's available to buy.
I don't know who to ask this question of. How do you explain? I know that we live in a culture of fear, which is driven in large part by the media and also in large part by how we as citizens react to the media, because we're so busy, we don't take the time to dig underneath. It's not our job necessarily as citizens to dig underneath the stories that we're seeing, hearing, reading in the news. But we live in a culture of fear. So how much of this is logical and how much of it simply is just irrational?
A lot of it is driven by what people hear. And so people hear about violence in the media all the time. There's a cliche that if it bleeds, it leads. Mm-hmm. And so what people are acquainted with is mayhem on a regular basis if it happens most anywhere, abroad or here.
And it's not just the news. It's in video games. It's in television dramas. It's in movies. Everybody's getting shot all the time.
There's a lot of violence. And there is the question about whether the depictions and the games that there are serve as a sublimation for people who are fascinated, mm-hmm. or whether it provokes and increases the likelihood. And it might go either way, I mean, you could say. And what we would have to look at, and that is the drift of general incidents of violence. And in the United States, at any rate, the homicide rate currently is at a 50-year low. Mm-hmm. And homicide rates in the United States and in all countries vary much more than their suicide rates. Suicide rates stay quite constant, while homicide rates, say, in the United States, can vary by an order of magnitude.
Do we know why our homicide rate is low right now?
We don't know, actually.
And if we had done this program when the homicide rate was much higher than it is today, would that number, 1,793 deaths by firearms in 2 months, been higher? Would it have been higher?
I don't know about that on a month-by-month basis.
In your paper, The Production of Criminal Violence in America, Is Strict Gun Control the Solution? You argue that it isn't the solution. Why isn't it the solution?
Well, if we understand strict gun control to be a program that aims at inducing scarcity of firearms in the general population as a way to reduce violence, that simply doesn't has not been effective. So when we look at homicide rates in the United States over a century, and we can get that information from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, not from partisan groups, mm-hmm. Readily available to anybody, we can see an order of magnitude fluctuation from 1900 until today. And why it goes up? Well, there was a steep rise during alcohol prohibition. When alcohol prohibition was repealed, there was a very steep decline, even though that was the Great Depression. Now, we think sometimes that social stresses, high unemployment, and other difficulties may increase people's violence, but we didn't see it during the Great Depression.
Hmm. You want to go on?
So I would just say to you that when we look at the homicide graph over a century, mm-hmm. People would be very hard-pressed to come forward with a theory that explains the graph.
When Bill Maher was talking about this on Friday night on his television show, he said Republicans have been known to be the party that loves guns, and Democrats have been known to be the party that likes guns, because everybody's afraid of saying anything negative about gun ownership. And I know, Congressman, that you have applauded the president's quick call for action to the violence at Sandy Hook. Well, that's a fairly brave stance, isn't it?
I don't think so. I think everybody has applauded looking into it. The question is, will we get to applaud any kind of results that come from it? And as I said earlier, the jury is still out on that.
Tenuous to take a stand on restricting gun ownership?
Well, I didn't take a stand on restricting gun ownership. I took a stand on coming up with a reasonable solution, and that's going to require a lot of work. We put together a coalition of 12 people from some rabid gun owners and advocates, some on the opposite side, and they've come up with 15 principles that I think would allow us to navigate through this.
We'll talk about that, and we'll talk about the president's plan, which you've called comprehensive and common sense, in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates, care for spine disorders since 1940, welcoming Dr. Kevin Cahill, a fellowship-trained spine surgeon, to its Huntersville and Charlotte locations, CarolinaNeurosurgery.com. AcademyAwards.com. Sunday night, it's the 85th Annual Academy Awards, and each year before the Oscars, we invite a trio of Charlotte movie critics to chime in with their own predictions of the winners, and also with the list of things that the list of movies and stars that they think should win. There are 9 Best Picture nominees this year, but only 5 director nominees. What does that mean? And are all those other award shows that precede the Oscars good predictors of the outcome? We find out what the critics think tomorrow at 9. Always a fun time. Hope you can join us then.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, 2/3 of people who died from gunshot wounds in 2010 were suicides. Debate over whether reducing access to guns could lower U.S. suicide rates.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Congressman Mel Watt from North Carolina's 12th Congressional District is with us, along with Larry Hyatt, owner of Hyatt Guns, and Dr. Lance Stell, professor of philosophy at Davidson College and the author of a paper on gun control. The production of criminal violence in America, is strict gun control the solution? Just prior to the break, Congressman, you were talking about getting together with a coalition of people who are rabid gun advocates, gun ownership advocates, and those who are not, and coming up with 15 principles that would help guide a discussion of this or take us to a point where we could do something about gun violence. Can you talk about that briefly?
Yeah. Interestingly enough, the very first principle is one that I think sometimes people on the left would have you ignore. The very first principle is you got to respect the Second Amendment. The Supreme Court has articulated, at least to some extent, what the Second Amendment means. And that's happened during the 20 years that I've been in Congress. When I went to Congress, you didn't have any guidance about what the Second Amendment
was. Well, let's talk about that, because Tom on email has asked us to read the actual Second Amendment on the air, all of it, and talk about the reasons for it. It's not long. Here it is. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That's the Second Amendment. What did the Supreme Court say about this?
Well, interestingly enough, most of what the Supreme Court said had little to do with the militia part of it. Basically, what it said is you got the right to have an arm, have arms to protect your household.
Let me read it again.
Okay.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Is that clause not dependent on the first, a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of the state?
Apparently,
really?
The Supreme Court doesn't think it's connected or dependent on the first part of it, because, it's read basically the ability, right of people to have arms for self-protection in their homes. That's basically what Heller generally is.
Because
is
if I'm not wrong about this, isn't the state of South Carolina considering a bill that would essentially start militias so you would have a reason to have a gun because you're a member of a militia?
Well, actually, when you think about what militia meant to the framers, they envisioned every free, able-bodied male mm-hmm. to be a member of the militia, and to be well-regulated meant that you were required by law to possess firearms. Mm-hmm. It's the first really unfunded mandate that the Congress of the United States ever passed, is a requirement to have a serviceable rifle, ball, and powder with other accoutrements. And that was imposed as a duty mm-hmm. on the citizenry, and so every able-bodied free male was to be enrolled. States varied in their ages what that meant, 16 to 45, 17 to 60. So that's what they envisioned. And Today, the Militia Act includes two things, the formal militia, which is the National Guard, and the informal militia, which is, again, able-bodied males in all the states, excluding females, interestingly.
Okay. Give me some of the other 15 guideposts here.
Reinstating the requiring background checks for every gun sale while respecting reasonable exceptions for cases such as gifts between family members. I think that's very balanced. And there may be quite a bit of consensus about that. Regulating high-capacity magazines to 10 or 12 so that an individual would have to reload. There may be a lot of consensus.
How long does it take to reload a magazine or an assault rifle?
Doesn't take very long, and that's one of the problems with some of the proposed legislation. The way guns are designed, the engineering of them, you mash the button, the magazine falls out, and you can put another one in. It's probably 1.4 seconds, mm-hmm. and you're reloaded. So,
it's a nuisance but not a deterrent.
Yes, and a mass shooter probably it wouldn't have any effect on that. I think we're all looking for something that would do something, but we just don't think the assault rifle ban and the magazine capacity ban would have any effect whatsoever and make our children safer.
You sold $1 million worth of merchandise the day after Sandy Hook, and that included selling out the rifle used in the Newtown shootings. People wanted that rifle. How do you explain that?
Well, that's a very popular product. There's a lot of similar ones made, and when people saw what happened in Sandy Hook, they thought they were going to be banned. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason they came out and bought them.
So, given the massive number of firearms that are already out there in legal possession of people who went through the background checks and who bought them under the current law, and those that are out there illegally that have been passed around to criminals or among criminals, and those that are we don't track because of individual sales are not tracked in this country – is it really even possible to pass any kind of gun control legislation that can control firearms? We don't even know where they are.
Well, that's right. There is no central list of guns in the United States.
Should there be?
Well, the reason there's not is because of fear of confiscation. You know, England is a great course, the United Kingdom. They registered shotguns, rifles, and handguns, and then later went right down the line and confiscated them. Same thing happened partially in Australia, and Dr. Steele, I'm sure, has a lot of data on this. The record has not been good, and you can go back to totalitarian governments. Hitler, that was one of the first things he did when he took power was take up all the guns.
Well, that's one rebellion. If you go to the Internet, that's one of the things that you see, that the Holocaust was caused by gun control.
Well, certainly people not being able to defend themselves didn't help. Everything's a lot more complicated. But any totalitarian regime does not want their people to have firearms. In the United States, we have had this wonderful Constitution, and we don't want to mess with it too much. We don't know what the unintended consequences of doing something that would divide the country farther than it is. It's pretty serious.
To the best of my knowledge, in the history of this republic, we have not had a single totalitarian regime. There are those who believe that the current one is, but we haven't had a single one, to the best of my knowledge. So what is the fear? There is this – I've heard people say, you will not take my gun away because I've got to defend myself from the government in case they come after my gun or they come after my property or whatever. The government has nuclear weapons. If the government wants something, they're going to take it, aren't they, Congressman?
Well, I think first of all, let me just respond to one thing Larry said. Anything we do, I think, will be prospective only. It's not going to go back and require taking away anything that's already out there, even background checks. Any kind of ban would be prospective only. So The prospect of going back and removing all the guns is off the table. And from my perspective, I mean, that's just not going to happen. So the question is, how do you get to a set of reasonable restrictions that are effective? The First Amendment reads as comprehensively clearer than the Second Amendment. The government shall not do anything to abridge free speech. Yet there are certain restrictions, reasonable restrictions, that we have placed on the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, how do you find a set of reasonable restrictions that have some impact on this? You're never going to solve the whole problem. And in a sense, I view my role as a member of the Judiciary Committee as trying to navigate down the center here to find what that set of reasonable constraints should be. You got people on the left who say nobody ought to have guns.
Mm-hmm.
You got people on the right who say everybody ought to have guns without any kind of constraints at all, because the Second Amendment says that. In the First Amendment area, you have people on the left who say you should never stop anybody from saying what they want to say. You got people on the right who say, well, that's ridiculous. You can't just say anything you want to say in any place that you want to say it. And our role in the Judiciary Committee has historically been to try to find what the reasonable constraints are, consistent with public opinion, consistent with the constitutional mandate, and that's a difficult thing to do.
Would gun owners, the ones that you deal with, Mr. Hyatt, would they view increased registration of firearms when you buy it? Well, background checks. Would they look at increased background checks as intrusive? Would it bother them?
Well, we already have pretty extensive background checks, and I don't think.
But only if you buy from you. If I buy from Professor Stell here under the table, not even under the table, just if he has a gun he wants to sell me, then I have a gun that nobody knows about.
That's right, and they call that the so-called loophole. But part of that's because the federal government really doesn't have control of in-state sales.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be at the state level.
But would that be viewed as something restrictive, intrusive, unconstitutional by people who own guns?
The gun people are, as Congressman Watts said, they're just divided as the whole country. You've got different people with different levels of what they think too much government control is. My personal thing is we do these background checks, and a lot of people bring firearms to our store, and we transfer from them to the other person, and we do the background check for them.
Mm-hmm.
It's for a small fee. If y'all wanted to sell a gun to each other, you could come to the store and actually have one gun transfer. But it's not law, and and people do that to protect themselves, and because they are responsible. They don't want to sell to someone that shouldn't have it.
And in a background check, what are you checking for?
You're checking for a lot. You're checking for criminal history. You're checking for military history. And I'm going to tell you something that's one reason I'm here tonight. It's appalling. We're checking for mental history. And I did not know this until recently, but our mental health check isn't very effective. There's so much information that people who have had severe mental issues, the sheriff's department doesn't get that information. The NICS system, the National Instant Background Check System, doesn't get that information. The concealed carry background checks from the FBI is not getting that information. If someone comes into our store to buy a firearm and they've got a mental issue, we need to know it, and that sale needs to be denied.
Is that the bigger issue here? Would that not stop a lot of the things that we have witnessed in this country in the last two or three years?
I would stick in a worry about this, and that is the people with mental problems are not overwhelmingly violent population. Some of them are. But the majority of people who are schizophrenic or who are depressed do not do violent acts at all. Some of the ones do, and they're the ones that come to our attention, disturbed, very disturbed people who are aberrant. Mm-hmm. And the temptation would be to come down hard on people with difficulties and deny them all kinds of civil liberties with a questionable issue about due process. Because if they get classified as a prohibited possessor, they are lifetime banned from ownership of a firearm, which enters into a psychiatrist's consideration as to how he classifies the person. And psychiatry is an imperfect aspect of medicine because predicting people's violence is very, very difficult. So I think we need to be careful with our zeal to nail people who are disturbed by over-inclusion. Of course, I think that people who are psychopaths should not be armed. But picking them out amongst all the people with mental health problems is very difficult for professionals like psychiatrists.
Because it seems to me that every single one of the problems we've heard about, from Sandy Hook to Aurora to Columbine to the shooting of Gabby Gifford and the people around her to what happened with this police officer recently in California, every one of them had mental instability problems.
Yes.
I think that's true, but that's like saying that every gun owner is a criminal. I mean, that's
Well, they're not. Of course not.
And you got a lot of people out there who use guns for legitimate hunting,
right,
other recreational purposes. You got a lot of mentally challenge people out there who never ever commit a crime. So the question is, how do you find the right ones and how you put reasonable constraints on? And that's one of the principles that's been articulated in this series of 15. But it's very, very difficult to articulate it in a way that and legislate in a way that is going to be effective in that area.
One of the prohibited possessors, and that is anyone addicted to illegal substances. Now, they're lifetime banned, but how we identify those individuals is very difficult.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, just defining what addiction means and applying that concept to an individual is not easy.
And, of course, not everybody who commits a crime is addicted to a legal substance or an illicit substance. Not everybody who commits a crime has a mental problem. Some people are just thugs. They're just criminals and they want stuff and they take it at the barrel of a gun, which raises the question, which has been raised many times, which is the problem, the prevalence of guns and their use in crimes, or the prevalence of criminals who use guns as their weapons of choice, which also follows another question. What's the answer, controlling the availability of guns or the number of criminals?
Well, if we look where guns are most prevalent, those states that have the highest gun prevalence, which places like Idaho and Wyoming and Montana, their homicide rates are very low. On the other hand, places where guns are not so prevalent, but they are concentrated in a fewer hands, in my hometown of Chicago, violence is very worrisome. And a lot of young people die and a lot of young males die in the gunfire, which is a tragic loss for our country. And how we would best address those difficulties seems to me, disarming them is not the first question. The question is, why do they feel that they need to use firearms to deal with their issues? Because they live, if you poll those young men, and many of them do not expect to survive to age 30, that is just tragic.
And they're probably right, and it's a culture of fear there as well.
They're right, tragically right, too much of the time.
Yeah. That's Dr. Lance Stell, professor of philosophy at Davidson College and a clinical professor of medicine at CMC. Also with us, Congressman Mel Watt from North Carolina's 12th Congressional District and Larry Hyatt, owner and president of Hyatt Guns. We have a lot of people with a lot of questions, which we'll get to in a moment after the break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Leap Design, a full-service web design and development studio empowering businesses and organizations with content-managed websites using WordPress and Drupal. Details at leapdesign.com. Two-thirds of people who died from gunshot wounds killings in 2010 were suicides. Diane Rehm and her guests explore the debate over whether reducing access to guns could lower U.S. suicide rates. The debate that we're having, or the conversation that we're having about gun control this morning, will be run for you again tonight with a slightly different bent, no doubt, on the stage of the Booth Playhouse at 7 o'clock. It's a WFAE public conversation. You can get information on how to attend at WFAE.org. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE, that's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, and WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
No spring pledge drive? You could make it happen. Once again, we are encouraging you to pledge early to eliminate days of our 10-day spring membership campaign. Last fall, thanks to you, we were able to reduce the drive by half. Can you imagine eliminating more? It's possible when you go online and contribute at WFAE.org and make your pledge. The clock is ticking, so help us make history by taking even more days off our upcoming fund drive. Thanks for making your pledge today.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, in advance of a public conversation on this topic tonight at 7 at the Booth Playhouse with our guests, as a matter of fact. We're having a conversation here on the radio this morning. Mel Watt is with us, the U.S. Congressman from the 12th Congressional District, Dr. Lance Stell, who has written a paper on gun violence, which essentially says that gun control is not the answer. He's a professor of philosophy at Davidson, and Larry Hyatt is the owner and president of Hyatt Guns, the largest gun store in the country. Let's take a couple of phone calls. Jim in Huntersville has been holding on for a while. Thank you, Jim, for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Mike. Thanks for taking my call. What I wanted to ask is whether they have this is an idea I heard from someone else. The idea of creating a license, almost like an endorsement on a license, where someone who wants to own guns, whether it's one or 100, doesn't matter, they can provide information about having taken safety classes, et cetera. And if they're qualified, hopefully you would check for mental things and all those if you can. And then they would be issued an endorsement on their license that says they can buy guns. And then when they go to a show, whether they go, in any case, when they purchase a gun, they can show the proof that they're allowed to buy guns. And there's no registration of the individual guns they buy. It's just a matter of them having proof that they're a safe and authorized owner of guns.
That sounds like a reasonable requirement. How would gun owners and buyers view that?
Most of them wouldn't have a problem. In fact, we really do that now with a concealed carry license. That's exactly what it does. If you have a concealed carry license and you present that at the gun store, you can buy your firearm right then. You've already had all your extensive background checks.
Seems much simpler, too. You go through it one time. You have a certificate that you show, or some kind of an indication on a driver's license or a gun license that says you're licensed to do this. What would be wrong with that?
Like I said, we have it, and we have other states use that system.
Do people have to be trained when they buy a gun, or can they just can I just walk into your store, having never touched a gun in my life, although I have, and buy a gun?
Once you've gone through the background checks, whether it's concealed carry or purchase permit or NICS check, you can buy the firearm. The stores give you the basic instructions. There's plenty of classes available.
What are the basic instructions?
Safety, how to load it, trigger locks, what happens if you drop the gun, where you store the gun, which is vital to our business, is
right.
Where you store that gun, because if a child gets it. And also, another issue is theft. The number one reason that guns get into the hands of these young men who are slaughtering themselves right. is through theft.
Because I took Dan Stark's class on guns. He used to be, a news reporter on Channel 36.
Yeah.
And one of the rules that he said for basic gun safety is never put your finger on the trigger unless you intend to pull it, and never point it at anybody unless you intend to shoot it at them. Shoot them.
Absolute good rules.
Okay. But people don't get that basic training when they buy a gun?
Well, they are told that when they buy it. And I will say this. We have so few accidents for the number of guns that exist that we'll have to say that the vast majority of gunners are very safe and very responsible.
Yesterday in the mail, Friday in the mail, we didn't have mail yesterday. But Friday in the mail, I got my registration notice for my car. Every year I get this notice. I have to get the car inspected. I got to pay the taxes on it, and I got to get a tag. So why don't we have that for guns?
Well, I think Dr. Steele can give you a real good reason on this, because of fear of confiscation.
That's all there is to it? Really?
Well, I can tell you that North Carolina did have such a law. It was enacted in 1840, and it only applied to free persons of color.
But if I continually have major accidents in which I endanger the lives of others with my car, they will take my license away, will they not? What's wrong with that?
Well, let me give you another good reason that it probably wouldn't work. I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution that
protects my right
protects
to drive
your
a car.
Right to drive a car, right?
Okay.
And so there'll be a lot of people over there saying there's a big, big difference between registering to drive a car and taking safety lessons. And, you know, that's the nature of the debate that you have here. And as you've seen with, I think, three reasonable guests on your show.
Mm-hmm.
These are very, very difficult issues to navigate through, and they present some very difficult challenges.
One thing we haven't brought up that was brought up in an article in The Week magazine is that it will come to – the guy who writing this article says it will come as no surprise to most people that men commit homicide 10 times as often as women. Their victims are often women. 2/3 of women killed by spouses are killed with guns. Firearm assaults on female family members and intimate acquaintances are approximately 12 times more likely to result in death than are assaults using other weapons. This is not some minor secondary issue, he writes. It is the heart of the matter, a form of chronic and pervasive domestic terrorism.
But you got to resist the temptation to jump to the conclusion from that all men should be restricted and women should not. So those are interesting statistics, but 99, 44, 100% of the men who have guns don't misuse guns.
So this is coming from a Democratic congressman who believes that the president's plan is a comprehensive and common sense series of administrative and legislative proposals, and yet you are pretty much sounding like a gun advocate.
There's nothing draconian in what the president has proposed, or little controversial in what he's proposed. From my perspective, there are some things that we would have to really evaluate to determine whether they would pass constitutional muster.
What has he proposed?
Well, he's proposed administrative things, really. All of the administrative things he's proposed, he can do without any legislation. So they are not draconian. Any kind of legislative proposals, we've got to vet very carefully to determine whether they will pass constitutional muster, because you've got a Supreme Court, you've got a court system that's going to have to determine whether any constraints we put on guns are reasonable constraints, just like they would determine whether any constraints we put on speech are reasonable constraints. And reasonable has no real definition. What did one of the justices said, I can identify
pornography
when I see it, but I can't define it. And that's the problem you have in this area. It's not that I'm being protective of gun owners or intimidated by any kind of gun lobby. But there are constitutional legal parameters within which we have to operate.
And Larry Hyatt, you've been nodding in agreement through most of this, including the part about the president's proposals.
Well, certainly the president's proposals on the mental health, absolutely. That is the one thing that I think that we're really interested in. And then, like Dr. Steele said, it's a lot more complicated than we might think it is. The advocacy for mental health people and not being targeted and discriminated against is obviously going to be another big part.
The vice president of the National Rifle Association predicted apocalyptic doom if the government makes it in any way more difficult to purchase or sell a firearm. He said hurricanes, tornadoes, riots, terrorists, gangs, lone criminals, these are perils we are sure to face, not just maybe. It's not paranoia to buy a gun. It's survival. You agree with that? Do your gun owners and buyers agree with that?
Well, each individual gun owner buys a gun for their own reason. For instance, the biggest buyers of guns right now are senior citizens and women. 10,000 people today turn 65. Mm-hmm. They can't run. They can't fight like they could. They feel more vulnerable to crime. And they're buying guns, and they're taking those concealed carry courses. And we're having to design guns where the trigger pull is a little easier and the grip's a little different, because people with arthritis and age have problems with some of the traditional guns. So it's a huge deal, and women are buying them because women have been big beneficiaries of this anti-discrimination laws. They have jobs they never had before. Yeah. They get married later. They live alone, a lot of them. And they feel more vulnerable not only to break-ins but to the sexual predator.
The reason that we're having this conversation today and the reason this has reared its head again is because of Sandy Hook and that tragedy involving school children, for crying out loud, which followed all these other incidents of innocent people in public places. But you've alluded to this, Dr. Stell, that the big problem in the country is not necessarily these incidents that make the headlines every day. It's the ones that don't. It's the constant shootings in urban areas around the country. And you say that outside of these mass shootings, which have been perpetrated mostly by young Caucasian males, America's lethal violence problem is overwhelmingly and disproportionately a problem among its young, poor African-American population. You point out that the Bureau of Justice Statistics reports that young African-American males are 6 times more likely to murder someone and 6 times more likely to be a murder victim than their white counterparts. In your paper, you say assaults by black offenders are more than twice as likely to result in a death than assaults committed by white offenders. But is that an argument against gun control?
It's not an argument against gun control. It's just a fact about the demographics of what we have. It is remarkable, I think, that the media has been so responsive to the Sandy Hook situation and comparatively blind to what happens day in and day out on the south side of Chicago.
Well, let's talk about that. If these statistics that he just pointed out with regard to the African-American young male population were applicable to the Caucasian population, would we be having a different conversation today? Would those statistics be in the news every day?
Mike, you're taking a gun debate, which is discussion, which is difficult in and of itself, and you're converting it to a race discussion, which makes it even more difficult. I think the professor is absolutely right that disproportionately this adversely impacts African American communities in a disproportionate way. There's no question about that. And he's right that the press and the media have picked up on Sandy Hook in ways that they would never pick up. But
that was because they were children, not because they were white children.
Now, these are children that are getting killed in African-American communities, in urban communities.
Right.
The sister of the girl who was standing on the stage behind the president got killed. She was not
innocent bystander.
Right. Okay. So these are, but I don't think you can take this and turn it to a race discussion because that complicates it even more.
Okay.
I'm going to resist the temptation to fall into that trap because this discussion of guns is difficult enough without superimposing on it all of the issues that go with race in this country. And there are significant issues of race that exist in this country. There are disparities in poverty rates. There are disparities in income. There are disparities in deaths by guns. But, we've got to solve this problem, and we've got to solve it in a way that solves it or at least ameliorates it for all segments of our society. And we've got to do it in a reasonable way. And that's that's the difficulty we have at this. That's the challenge we have at this point.
Dennis emails, this is very nearly an exact quote from Wayne LaPierre of the NRA. Americans need assault weapons and large capacity magazines to protect their families. Really, would a shotgun or a handgun not do the trick?
Well, let me. I bet you Larry will agree with me that the two spokespersons for the NRA are not doing any of us any favors. They are not the people I would want out there articulating this on the, if that's the right, any more than I would want a set of different people out there articulating the issue on the left. We're trying to find responsible, reasonable solutions that go down the middle of a very contentious issue. And to the extent we have those statements that are basically hyperbole, they do us no good. And I think Larry would probably be the first person to agree with me on that.
Well, I definitely have some agreement with a congressman, and I will say this too. We, as far as defending one's home, they do not need a semi-automatic rifle or a big magazine.
Why do they buy them now?
Because they want them.
And why do they want them?
I can tell you this. Well, let me get to that. They want them, and even I don't know all the reasons, but I can tell you this. They're buying them, okay? They're taking their hard-earned money and buying them.
Are they buying them for the same reason people buy cars that are powerful that go 0 to 60 in 4 seconds, because they can and because they like that power? It's a cool object to have?
Perhaps, but I mean, we have to keep in mind that the weapons that they're talking about, they're called assault weapons, but they're not really an assault rifle. They look like what the military has, but they don't function that way. And the cartridge that they fire is not remarkably powerful, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, on the scale of things that is used to is in firearms, the cartridge is shot in something like the AR pattern gun is really not very powerful.
But the police are allegedly outgunned by some of the guns on the streets in the hands of criminals, are they not?
They say so, and that's why they want full automatic weapons, and they dress in military gear and have what looks like tanks to ride around in. That's sort of terrifying.
I want to thank our panelists, Larry Hyatt from Hyatt Guns, Dr. Lance Dell from Davidson College, and Mel Watt, the congressman from the 12th Congressional District, for this conversation, which will go on and on and on as long as there is a Second Amendment in perpetuity.